Well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for being here this evening. We are in Genesis chapter 6, verses 1 through 22. We're going to try to read through the whole thing and begin to take a look at it. I'm going to read Genesis chapter 6, NIV, verses 1 through 22, the whole chapter. And here we go. Chapter 6, verse 1. When men began to increase in number on the earth and daughters were born to them, the sons of God saw that the daughters of men were beautiful, and they married any of them that they chose. Then the Lord said, "My spirit will not contend with man forever, for he is mortal, or flesh. His days will be 120 years." The Nephilim were on the earth in those days, and also afterward, when the sons of God went to the daughters of men and had children by them. They were the heroes of old, the men of renown. So in review right here, it appears we're introducing four classes of beings, people. Nephilim, you're going to have the sons of God. You're going to have the daughters of men. And then the union between the sons of God and the daughters of men are going to produce the offspring. These are, again, from the sons of God and the daughters of men, these are their children. They became the heroes, things that legends are made of, written about. The question would be, are the offspring the Nephilim? Are the Nephilim the sons of God? Do we have one, two, three, four groups? Or do we have one, two, three groups? Or one, two, three groups? So I'm thinking there's four different things happening here. Previously, I thought the Nephilim could be the offsprings of the sons of God and the daughters of men. But we continue. Verse 4, the Nephilim were on the earth in those days and also afterward when the sons of God went to the daughters of men and had children by them. They were the heroes of old, the men of renown. The Lord saw how great man's wickedness on the earth had become and that every inclination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil all the time. We'll look at that verse tonight. The Lord was grieved that he had made man on the earth, and his heart was filled with pain. Now, that's going to be repeated something like that in chapter 7. It's like he was grieved that he had made man. So the Lord said, "I will wipe mankind whom I have created from the face of the earth, men and animals and creatures that move along the ground and birds of the air, for I am grieved that I have made them." That word means pain. He's looking for some kind of consolation or some kind of comfort in this disaster. And again, notice that could be the whole situation, if you allow the sons of God to be angels, it would involve angelic rebellion. Definitely, mankind is in rebellion, but the judgment's going to take care of all the animals also. I mean, he's destroying everything. And so you say, well, why should the people be judged if there's an angelic causing the confusion? Well, you can go one step further. Why would the animals be destroyed because of man's evil? It's all this system. That's the way the whole process works. And that's, you know, we are part of this system. And when we sin, it affects the things around us. And so that something's taken place here. So if people can ask questions about that. But nonetheless, he was grieved that he made them, mankind. But Noah found favor in God in the eyes of the Lord. Now we're going to have to look at that again. Found favor. Open up to chapter 6. Favor, is that something that Noah earned? Noah was being righteous, and God says, "I'll wipe out everybody, but I'll save him," so that he's the only righteous person on earth. Or favor, is that just God's grace? I'm going to choose somebody and spare him because I got to keep the human race going. We'll look at that word when we get into the New Testament. It kind of sounds like Noah was, well, he's going to be called righteous in his generation. So it seems like Noah is doing something that's responding to God. You know, he'd be earning this instead of just randomly chosen off the street as the one that's going to go into the next part of the creation. Genesis chapter 6, verse 9. This is the account of Noah. And there's your toledot formula. This is the written documents of Noah. Noah was a righteous man and blameless among the people of his time, and he walked with God. Now again, walked with God sounds like Enoch. Noah had three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Now, we repeat what we said before. Now, it would appear that chapter 6, 1 through 8 would be, if I can say this, something Moses edited into the text. He's connecting the documents. That's me saying that. But then, verse 9 is where now he's taken the writings of Noah and bringing them over, saying, now, this is what Noah wrote in his diary, the document of Noah. Because now you get, we've already heard this in the introduction, but now it says it again. It says, verse 11, it's kind of a repeat. Now the earth was corrupt in God's sight and was full of violence. There's your word, Hamas. God saw how corrupt the earth had become, for all the people on the earth had corrupted their ways. When we get to these verses, we're going to talk about that word corrupt. It's going to be used several times here. God saw how corrupt the earth had become, for all the people of the earth had corrupted their ways. So God said to Noah, I am going to put an end to all the people, for the earth is filled with violence because of them. I am surely going to destroy them. Also a form of the word corrupt. They had become corrupt. They corrupted their ways. God says, okay, I'm going to now corrupt them, which is similar to Romans. Thinking to be wise, they became foolish, and they began to go astray. And God says, finally, he just handed them over to their position. So again, if someone wants to destroy themselves and rebel against God, God will help them, try and bring them back. But eventually it's like, fine, you want to get destroyed? Here's destruction. And he gives it to them. Ultimately, it's going to be eternal damnation. I'm going to put an end to all the people, for the earth is filled with violence because of them. I am surely going to destroy both them and the earth. So he's talking to Noah. Now we'll talk about this. Someone made a comment also this last week on one of the videos somewhere about how can you teach a book about things that people just heard voices and wrote it down. They just heard voices. What do we do about people hearing voice? We call it a mental illness today. Why would you waste your time teaching just things, you know, voices people heard? Now, that would be in this case right here, assuming that Noah is, you know, out, you know, mowing his yard, you know, plowing his field, you know, eating lunch, and it starts hearing voice. You should build a boat. You should build a boat. And it's like, you know, I keep hearing that I should, this voice in my head. Now, I'm going to say this. If you're hearing voices in your head, you should build a boat. Then you should go get help. I mean, that's a problem. That is not what's taking place in the Bible. It's not like, do you hear that? No, I don't hear that. Well, I hear that. I mean, you've got mental disease that can be a problem. You've got demonic activity. But when you look in, and I replied with an idea here, that the Bible is not an account of people hearing voices. They're people going through life, and the Lord intervenes. He like appears to them. And he gives them directions. Look at Abraham. I mean, we could go through the list. The Lord didn't like just speak to Abraham. You know, the Lord said to Abraham, go to the land I'm going to show you. And you get the impression, if you just read a surface reading, that Abraham is in Ur of the Chaldeans, and it's just like going down his day. And all of a sudden, you should move to a land that you've never been to before. You know, I was thinking that the other day. Who is that? I'm just going to believe. And he goes there. That could be, the problem is that at several places in Abraham's life, at important points, the Lord does what? He appears to Abraham. In fact, when you go to the book of Acts and read Stephen's reference back to it, it says the Lord of glory appeared to our father Abraham in Ur of the Chaldeans. So Abraham heard no voices. The Lord of glory, the Lord that spoke to Adam in the garden, that appeared to Enoch, apparently, that is going to walk in on Noah, talks to Moses multiple times, appeared to him. all the way through, is going to appear to Abraham. So these people are not hearing voices. They're having a divine manifestation where God comes into creation. And again, you break it down, Father, Son, Holy Spirit, it's the Son of God coming into history and speaking. No one's seen the Father. Jesus said this. So anytime anyone has seen God, it's been a manifestation of the second member of the Trinity. He eventually is going to take on human flesh and become what we call him, Jesus, the man who he actually is going to join the human race. But throughout the Old Testament, so when I say this right here, verse 13. So God said to Noah, that's not a voice. Now, if you want to go all Sunday school on me, you just believe the voices in your head. Well, no, this is God walking in, I'm going to say, on Noah and telling him, I'm going to put an end to all people, for the earth is filled with violence, Hamas, because of them. I am surely going to destroy both them and the earth. You're going to see here how many times the word Eretz is in here for earth. It's repeated over. It's talking about the earth is going to be destroyed. No, there's no indication that this is a local flood. That's a cop-out coming out of the 1800s. People got scared. We can't, what are we going to do? It must be just a local flood that got exaggerated. This doesn't even make sense. If there's not a universal flood that wipes everything out, this is garbage. This makes no sense at all. He's going to flood the Euphrates area, the land between the rivers, the Mesopotamian area. It's like, and then it grows into a legend. Well, then I will tell you, if this is a legend, that was the land between the two rivers, between the Tigris and Euphrates, that land got flooded, and some guy ran up on a mountain and saved his goat. And they said, and then he came down and began telling stories. Well, the Lord God spoke to me, and I built this big boat and took all the animals, well, mainly my goat, and, well, we floated for days. Well, I went up on a mountain, and it's like, well, then I would tell you, give up. Turn in Christianity. Find something real. Because if this is not a true story, even Peter refers to this as an example of the second coming of Christ. People will forget the flood so they can deny the fact that Jesus is going to intervene in history again. So there's no doubt, if you're a Christian, if you believe the Bible, there's no doubt in my mind, you don't need to turn this into a local flood that got exaggerated. This is God coming to Noah and saying, we're going to wipe it out. And when you start looking at the geography or the layers of the sediment layers that come about, the fossil records, we'll talk more about that. It's the easiest way to explain how our earth is formed was God creating it in Genesis 1 and then a flood destroying it and reshaping it, which again means the time before the flood and how everything functioned is different than what it's going to be like after the flood. Something drastically changed. Okay, here we go. I'm going to say, it doesn't say in the text that God appeared to Noah, but it doesn't say Noah heard a voice in his head either. So I'm going to go with the way Genesis usually has. Look, Adam didn't hear a voice in his head, and they didn't hear a voice in their head and hid themselves. They heard the sound of the Lord God walking in the garden, and he walked up to him and talked to him. He talked to Cain. So I'm going to say the Lord appeared to Noah. I'm adding that to the text. This is a theophany. This is the Shekinah glory. This is God appearing to Noah. I'm going to put an end to all people, for the earth is filled with violence because of them. I am surely going to destroy both them and the earth. So make yourself an ark of cypress wood. That's a tough word we're not real sure exactly what that is. Make rooms in it and coat it with pitch, that's tar, inside and out. This is how you are to build it. We'll talk more about these measurements. The ark is to be 450 feet long, 75 feet wide, and 45 feet high. There is no, if you're going to be honest with this and analyze this, there's no room for laughing at this and making fun of it. He's not making a yacht. He's not making a sailboat. He's making a barge. It's like, how is he going to steer it? It's not designed to be steered. It's designed to float. It's designed to stay above the water. It's a barge, basically. Make a roof in it and that roof probably refers to a skylight, so you get light coming in. Make a roof in it, and finish the ark to within 18 inches of the top. So you've got 18 inches, up to 18 inches, you're going to have tar, pitch, all the way up. It's going to be watertight, which means it's not sitting on the water, it's a barge riding in the water, as close to a submarine as you can be without being a submarine. You've got about, I'm not sure how much is going to be out, you could do tests on it. But I mean, these are not fanciful measurements. You know, you talk here, the Gilgamesh tablet, British Museum and other places, the boat, they talk about their boat too, but sometimes they're ridiculous. One, they're round, or they're very tall, like a tall building, and then the guy steers it with a steering wheel on the top. I mean, it's like, now you're getting into fiction. Now you're getting into things that someone was telling a story, and it got stranger and stranger and stranger every time you told the story. This right here, I'm not going to be able to prove this to you, but if we needed to, we could go out and build a ship, a barge this size, put tar on it, get in it, and it would float. We could sail across the ocean in it, I would assume, if you could get it, you know, put a motor on it or something. Okay. I mean, this is not ridiculous. Verse 17, I am going to bring floodwaters on the earth to destroy all life under the heavens. Every creature that has the breath of life in it, everything on earth will perish. But I will establish my covenant with you. I'm going to make a deal with you. I'm going to make a treaty with you. I'm going to make a promise to you. Here's what I'm going to do with you. And you will enter the ark. So in other words, God is saying, I'm going to do something with you, special with you. It's not like Noah's got it. You do this for me, I'll do this for you. I'm going to do something for you. I'm going to tell you how to avoid this, and I'm going to use it to my advantage. It's a covenant. You and your sons, your wife and your sons' wives with you. He's got three sons and three wives, so that equals then the eight people. Now again, this causes, just in passing by, this causes a question for me, because Noah's going to be an old man and he's only got three sons. Maybe there's a little more discussion here, but I would think Noah's going to have, like all of these guys, had many other sons and daughters. So that remains a question mark. Why are they not mentioned? Why are they allowed to drown? Why are only three chosen? Are there only three sons? Again, but I will establish my covenant. And I read through all the decks. There's three decks on the thing. I'll have to do it next week. How much room is on this ark? It is, and you've gone down and seen the ark display. And so if I get a wrong perspective, feel free to interrupt, because he's talked with Noah himself. He's seen the ark, and it was made to these dimensions, and it looks logical, right? It doesn't look like a ridiculous fairy tale. It looks like we could get on this thing and float if we needed to. Oh, okay. So there's one in Hong Kong also. Okay, so it looks legitimate. I mean, it doesn't look. Oh, in Hong Kong or down south? I mean, where's it at? Kentucky, and it looks like. I shouldn't even be teaching this class. You guys should be teaching this class. Great. Oh, now I'm scared. Oh, usually I can just make stuff up, but now these guys all know. But the three decks, the layers on it, when you start talking about how many animals, I mean, everybody's trying to make it ridiculous, but if you talk about the species, the gender, not gender, but the families of the animals, and the size of the animals, because they talk, one of the things I'll tell you next week is if you figure that all the animals were, the number of animals that would need to be on it to save all the species, and they're all the size of a sheep, you'd use up this much space, you'd still have like an entire floor. But not all, a lot of the animals are much smaller than a sheep, so it ends up being a lot of room, and like also they say, it's not a zoo. This is not like a floating zoo, where you're going to walk around and look at the animals. They compare it to a cattle car on a train where you're just putting these animals wall to wall to wall, packed in, taking them from point A to point V over a period of time, not intending for them to live there, to be observed, or for them to breed. You're just shipping them from here to here. And this is the case. They're just storing the animals for a period of time. So you don't need, you know, place for the birds to fly and a place for the sheep to graze. Just pack them in. And they're not even packed in like cattle. Okay, we'll talk more about that. You to bring onto into the ark two of all living creatures, male and female, to keep them alive with you. Two of every kind of bird, of every kind of animal, and of every kind of creature that moves along the ground will come to you to be kept alive. We'll talk about that. You are to take every kind of food that is to be eaten and store it away as food for you and for them. Last verse, Noah did everything just as God commanded him. And he's talking about building and getting ready for the animals. Now, chapter 7 will begin there at a later time. Now, looking at your notes, a lot of chapter 6, verse 1 is, you know, on page 1. As men began to multiply on the face of the earth, daughters are born. Goes through all the things we looked at last week. We're not going to review all that. We could spend a lot of time. I really want to spend more time investigating the Nephilim. That is something we just got to kind of leave sitting there. They were on the earth after the flood also. We've already talked about the sons of God and daughters of men. Pretty clear the daughters of men were daughters of men. The question really here is sons of God. What were they? Were they from the line of Seth? Were they royalty? Were they angelic beings? And then this group right here, this seems to be some of the, and oftentimes almost supernatural in size. Are they the same thing as the Nephilim? When we talk about Nephilim, a lot of times it's just translated giants. The word means the fallen ones. It's someone that refers to someone that has like laid down, almost like laid down in submission. They're just laid down. Not necessarily dead, but just. And so, who are these Nephilim? They're on the earth before and after. There's ideas on that. They appear to be connected in Moses' writings in the advance of the Israelites going to the promised land. And when they get there, they seem to be connected with the very, very tall, the tall groups of people that seem to be intimidating, great warriors. Again, you know, we see some of that in the Philistia, the Philistines. So again, that is going to pop up again in the book of Judges. That's going to pop up in throughout David's battles. It's going to appear in Moses' writings later on. So we leave it right there with that. You also see it in the New Testament. Very clearly, it seems, both Peter and Jude referring to this being an angelic activity. And that after this, the angels were locked up where they'll never be released until the time of the judgment. Jude actually quotes from the book of 1 Enoch where it's being talked about. Now, if you skip into the book of 1 Enoch, a book recorded around the time of the Maccabees at 300 to 100 BC, talking about the events of Enoch, it was very popular in Jesus' time, in the New Testament time, in 1st century BC, 2nd century BC. They knew the book of Enoch. It's not in the scriptures. If you go, I think, in the Ethiopian Bible has incorporated the book of Enoch in it, and it gives you great detail. And if you're familiar with the book of Enoch, it's pretty impressive, pretty intimidating about what is going on in the spiritual realm. I can't endorse that as a Bible teacher, but I can say Jude quotes from it, and he is referring in those same, of course, Jude's a very short book, about the angels when they sinned and left their proper place of that they'd been appointed to. And those angels were the ones that came down and infiltrated the human race. So there's a connection. It's not a solid biblical connection, but there is writers of the New Testament that really seemed like they embraced the concept that the sons of God were angelic beings that infiltrated the ranks. Now, unless we're going to do an entire study on that, we'll leave that sit there. I tend to think that's what happened. And I think what was happening was the seed of the woman that was going to bring about salvation of mankind and crush, just like God says, the seed of the woman will bruise the serpent's head. Same word, he'll bruise his heel, he'll bruise his head, or crush his heel or crush his head, same word. that there'd be the priority of Satan and the fallen angels would be, we need to stop the seed of the woman. I mean, they know when God speaks, things come into existence. God spoke and the world came into existence. And it talks in Job, they rejoiced. When they saw him speak, the angels rejoiced and sang when the earth appeared. Well, now God says, well, in punishment, the seed of the woman's going to bruise the head of the serpent. It's like, well, they know they're going to be destroyed according to God's plan. How? Some human born of a woman is going to be their downfall. And so if we can stop the people from being born, that's what God keeps saying, multiply, multiply. And he says, you're going to be saved because of the children. There's someone coming that's going to save humanity. Paul refers to that in Timothy. Women will be saved through childbearing. It talks about everyone's salvation and if they continue in God's plan. Now you get into the idea of even how evil, again, get political for a moment, how evil is abortion. It's like it's going right down the plan. Let's just keep snuffing out humanity before they become active in God's plan to overthrow evil. And so anyway, that's enough on that right there. We're going to now go to page 3 of the notes. Then the Lord said, my spirit shall not abide or will not contend with man forever, and his days will be 120. And I think right there, I think that is the date. There's 120 years until the flood. I'm going to go with that. It could be limiting man's years from living for 700, 800, 900 years. But I think if we look at the date of the when the flood comes, Noah is being told 120 years before that. Methuselah was told, what, sometime he lived 969 years? Is that how many years it was? Methuselah lives this many years and that dies the year of the flood. Enoch was told back here that when Enoch and Methuselah dies, the flood will come. So potentially, Noah has two dates from God on when the flood comes. 120 years, and when Grandpa Methuselah dies, it's going to come. So, again, that's one way of looking at it. Chapter 6, verse 4, the Nephilim, or English Standard Version, giants, were on the earth in those days, and also afterwards, we refer to that, when the sons of God came to the daughters of men, and they bore children. These were the mighty men of who were of old, the men of renown. And there's a bunch of information there that we've covered. Page 4, page 5. Here we go. And the Lord regretted that he had made man on the earth, and it grieved him to his heart. And I've got some things written down right there. First, I've got it circled right there. The word eretz right there, and if you read Hebrew, you can see in chapter 6, verse 6, you can see the word eretz circled there. And it says on the earth, but in the box, those two words, and he was sorry, and was sorry, that's the word nachem, which we've seen when we talked about Noah and comfort, and it means to be sorry or to console oneself. So in this case, God is sorry and looking for some way to console himself. I wished it wasn't like this. How am I going to solve my problem? I mean, you go home and your roof is leaking. Your roof is leaking. Now, how am I going to... I'm sorry about my leaking roof. Well, okay. But the next step is, how are you going to console yourself with your leaking roof? Well, I'm going to go up there and find the leak, I'm going to patch the hole, I'm going to fix the problem, I'm going to console my sorrow. He's not just over in the corner of the universe crying. He's like, okay, I've got my roof is leaking. How will I console myself? I'm sorry, and the sorry is going to lead to some kind of action so that I'm not sorry. The whole plan of salvation, God is sorry for the fall. What am I going to do? I'm going to work a plan to, so all of human history is God consoling himself. Why he made man, why man sinned, what am I going to do so in the end I'm not sorry my roof is leaking. I'm not sorry that man is a sinner. I know I'm going to eventually send Christ. He'll pay for the sins. We'll start the new creation. He'll be the firstborn from the dead. Others will follow him in the resurrection. We'll have a new heaven and new earth there. I was sorry and I consoled myself. I fixed the problem. So this is nothing more than God saying, I'm sorry, I've got a problem, I need to fix this. It's not like, oh, don't you feel sorry for me? I make a universe, there's nothing I can do. That's not the idea. So the Lord regretted that he had made man on the earth, and it grieved him to his heart. And the word grieved, you can see I've got a box around there. It's atsab. It means atsab. It means to hurt, pain, grief. Now we've seen in the garden, Eve, after she sinned, was talked about the pain, the grief she would have. Adam, when he sinned, there's going to be pain and grief that he would share in. And all of creation is, Romans chapter 8, is moaning under the pain of the burden of futility. All of creation is in pain and is grieving. Well, now, God himself is, because of the sin of man, it has affected God. Again, not in the sense that, I don't know what to do, I'm hurt, I'm painful, my feelings are hurt. That's not the idea. It's that he is feeling, he's not outside, he is outside the universe, but the idea here is that he's going to destroy this earth in this phase and re-engage it, to take it, and not just say, he could have just wiped it out and everybody died and we would never be here and there'd be no story. But that doesn't fix the problem. He doesn't just wipe everybody out. He's like, I'm going to fix this problem. And he's figuring out a way. Okay, so the Lord says, how am I going to fix this problem? Verse 7. So the Lord said, I will blot out man whom I have created from the face of the land. The word earth again. Man and animals and creeping things and birds of the heavens. For I am sorry that I have made them. They've made me. I'm sorry my roof is leaking. I need to figure out how to fix it. And he says, I'm going to fix it by drowning everybody and starting over with this creation. Now, chapter 6, verse 8. But Noah, in this case right here, there's going to be, and this has to happen, because the seed of the woman, I mean, look how close God has taken this down. I mean, this is a precision destruction. The seed of the woman is going to crush the serpent's head. Well, he's now going to destroy everyone who's a seed of the woman. He made a promise. The serpent's head will be crushed by a human, a man. We'll just say mankind, a particular individual will do the work. Well, now I'm just going to wipe them all out. If he wipes them all out, that promise, Satan will never be destroyed. Evil will never be resolved. It will be an unresolved issue for all time. So Noah finds favor. And this favor is an interesting word. It could go a couple of ways. Again, basically, it could be earned or it could be grace. In other words, I'm going to destroy mankind, but I got to keep the seed of the woman alive, so you.
It could be like when I put you in water.
Exactly. It's like when I chose you, you get to go and have favor. Or it could be, and it's going to talk about this, earned. Again, in the sense that of all mankind, Adam is obedient. Adam is righteous. Noah is blameless. So somewhere, now see what I'm saying? If you say, he earned this, and he's going to wipe out everybody, then you've got to kind of entertain the thought. But if it's earned, and Noah earned this, that would mean nobody else earned it. That it was so high, so precise. So you almost have to think, there must have been somebody else. Of all the people, there's millions of people on the earth at this time that were still following God. Or else, well, we'll read about it. Maybe there wasn't. Maybe Noah's the last man standing. But if there's more, then this favor would be, I've got to choose one, and I chose this one. Not because you're better than everybody, but I need somebody. I'm going to choose you. And that could go either way. In fact, let's look at that. But Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. I've got it in a box right there. It's the word matzah. You can see it right there. And it's just translated in the transliteration, found. It can mean to attain to, It can mean to find. And I've got, that's what the notes are all about. Again, point A, it says that, winning favor or receiving grace. This is used in Genesis in these places. It's used several times. I've got it underlined in the word favor in bold. Lot in Sodom and Gomorrah speaking to the angels, and he says, "Behold, your servant has found favor in your sight, and you have shown me great kindness in saving me, saving my life. But I cannot escape to the hills, lest the disaster overtake me and I die." And the angel says, "Run to the hills." He says, "Oh, it's too far for an old man. Can I at least go and find a town nearby?" And he says, "Found favor in your sight." And again, that's the word favor, and then in your sight. So that's almost like, you came to save me, can I get a little bit more? Jacob says to Esau, when he's returning from Paddan Aram, he says, "I have oxen and donkeys and flocks and male servants and female servants. I have sent to tell my Lord in order that I may find favor in your sight." In other words, I've sent these animals ahead for you to receive so that I might find favor. I'm trying to earn the favor. Esau said, "What do you mean by all this company that I met?" Jacob answered, "To find favor in my sight." So in other words, he's trying to grease the wheels of grace. You know, I want grace, so I'm going to go ahead and send some animals and some gifts ahead so you find favor. And then the Lord is with Joseph, and he became a successful man, and he was in the house of his Egyptian master. His master saw that the Lord was with him and that the Lord caused all that he did to succeed in his hands. So Joseph found favor in his sight, in Potiphar's sight, and attended him, and he made him overseer. So there's other people receiving favor, and that word's being used the same way. So I really can't say, except when you read in the New Testament, Noah seems to be a righteous man. If nothing more, then he received favor, and obviously you could receive favor and then disobey. God may choose you, "Hey, I chose you, build an ark," and you say no. So he may have been chosen out of, you know, just grace, and then he obeyed and became righteous. Or he may have been, you know, obeying way back here, had been righteous, blameless. In fact, Noah begins his book, his toledot, what is it, verse 6 or 7, where he identifies himself as being blameless. Right here, he calls himself blameless. Chapter 6, verse 9. This is the account of Noah. And this would be Noah's writings. This would be Noah's. Noah was a righteous man, blameless among the people of his time. That's how the book of Noah begins, the toledot of Noah. So someone wrote that. And it's, I'm going to tell you as I read through these verses, chapter 6, 7, and 8, and 9, it sure seems like Noah's the one writing it. He's like a diary of what's going on. He's going to tell you how high the waters were. He's going to tell how many days the birds went out and came back. So I would guess, just like Job identifies himself as blameless, upright, Noah's doing the same thing. So I'm thinking Noah's a righteous man, but also God chose him for this mission. Okay. And Noah has three sons, chapter 6, verse 10, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Now, chapter 6, verse 11, "Now the earth was corrupt in God's sight, and the earth was filled with violence." If you look in the Hebrew right there, I've got a square box around the first word, reading Hebrew backwards. That's the word shahat, or shahat, and it means corrupt. In fact, it's here it says, the earth is going to come up. This is going to be the theme word coming up. It was corrupt. The earth was corrupt in God's sight, and the earth was filled with violence. That word violence is the technical word that I used to write Hope for America's Last Generation. Hamas means violence. That's how it's translated. But it's social oppression. It's society not treating people right. It can be the rich oppressing the poor. It can be the elite driving the middle class into poverty. It's something about abusing the other people in your culture so that you have a violent culture. So if you take a group of people, say the elite, and they take the middle class and drive them into poverty, that's violence. But how are the middle class that were driven to poverty going to respond? They're going to respond with rebellion or violence. And now you've got this cultural upheaval, and that would, you know, reading in the rest of Moses' writings, reading through the prophets, Jeremiah, Isaiah, Proverbs that describes the fourth generation is the Hamas generation. It calls them Hamas. And so they are, in a sense, a fourth type of generation. They are corrupt in God's sight, and the earth was filled with violence. And I've summed that up as social injustice, and not just, you know, having to march in the streets or something, but I mean, you're just being driven into the ground. And so the whole earth was treating people, animals, everything. Well, let's read on. And God saw the earth, there's your word eretz again, and behold, it was, there it is again, corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted their way on the earth. So in chapter 6:11 and chapter 6:12, you've got the earth was corrupt. It was corrupt, in verse 12. Flesh had corrupted their way on the earth. And then chapter 6, verse 12, on the next page, I've got it in a box right there. There's the word corrupt again. And God said to Noah, I have determined to make an end of all flesh. Because the world was corrupt, and all flesh had corrupted their ways, God says, it's over. I'm going to turn this back on itself so it gets destroyed. This is God's modus operandi. I mean, you can see this in this story. You can see this in Israel's, the prophets. You can see it in the book of Deuteronomy. These are the things God says, if you've got a generation that doesn't come back, I'll do this. And finally, I'll just turn it back on itself and you'll be laid waste. Romans chapter 1 describes this, where God will let the corruption destroy you. So it's one of those things. If you want to be evil, God will take his hand off you and let you go, but you're going to your disaster. It'd be the opposite of having favor with God, of God saying, go ahead. I don't choose you. You do whatever you want. And he knows the result. Without him, the result is going to be destruction. So he's going to destroy the earth. So chapter 6, verse 14. Okay, wait. I got to read verse 6, 13. And God said to Noah, I have determined to make an end of all flesh. Now notice the word. We've already talked about earth, the whole earth. And now we're going to talk about all. There's no way of reading this chapter as a local flood, because it's the earth. And it's not some flesh, it's all flesh. It's not some animals, it's all animals. Unless it's totally corrupt. And if it's totally corrupt, you've got nothing to work with. I mean, give up. Or just join a church and pretend you're got some moral values or something. And God said, no, I have determined to make an end of all flesh, for the earth is filled with Hamas, or violence, through them. Behold, I will destroy them with the earth. And there, again, that word I've got in the box there, shakath, that's another form of shahat, or corruption, where God says, I will destroy them. He's saying, I will corrupt them. They want to be corrupt? I will corrupt them. Meaning flood them and they're going to rot and decay, become oil reserves for the 21st century. Chapter 6, verse 14, make yourself an ark of gopher wood, make rooms in the ark and cover it inside and out with pitch. And this is how you are to make it. The length of the ark, and we'll get into this more next week, but the length of the ark is 300 cubits. Now, what they work with here, and it's accurate, one cubit is equal to 18 inches. Now, I think there's an early cubit and a late cubit that may fluctuate by a few. Do you know right offhand the difference? But there's an early cubit and a late cubit. But this is, because like this is Genesis. Then by the time they get into the New Testament and they're measuring, the cubit may, I don't know which way it goes. But this cubit is 18 inches or a foot and a half. And so I wrote it down there for you. So the idea is there, real quickly, if that's a fair, and again, you guys have seen this before, it's more of a barge, and it's within 18 inches of the top, it's going to have tar and pitch, so it's designed to ride in the water, and so with all the turbulence that's going to be coming up and floating around, it's going to rock and roll in the tsunamis of the flood, but it's not going to capsize.
Like a lifesaver,
but way better. Right, exactly. It's going to ride the waves. Exactly. Chapter 6, verse 16, make a roof, a skylight for the ark. And again, the English Standard Version takes the roof and says skylight. So in other words, it's not a roof. Of course, he's going to be able to take the roof off at the end, but the idea of getting light in there. And finish it to within a cubit or 18 inches above. And set the door of the ark in its side. So there'll be a door to come in. Make it with lower, second, and third decks. So there's going to be, here's one deck on the bottom. Here's a second deck here. Here's a third deck there, if you would. So you're tripling the size of the room. And again, listen, there's so many measurements and details in here that if this is a legend, you can add, just like I did, I made a mistake, but you can take those numbers and put it together and nothing's going to fit. I mean, you picked up right away when I made a mistake. But this right here, with this size, with these three layers, with the number of animals that we're going to put in this ark, all of a sudden, it does work. Let's look at a couple other things here. Chapter 6, verse 17. For behold, I will bring a flood of waters upon, again, plural, waters upon the earth to destroy all flesh in which is the breath of life under heaven. Everything that is on the earth shall die. Now, obviously the fish are going to remain in the water, and I've got some more information for you next week, but here's some things I want to point out as we close this down. Because this is a huge story. Because Christians have to be able to defend it, explain it, paraphrase it, reject it, something. You're going to have to come down on it. And some great scholars, people that I admire, conservatives, and it's a tough age to live in. And I think we know that. I mean, we live in a beautiful country, beautiful age. Everything's fine. We got food. We got friends, we got transportation, we got freedom, go America. But philosophically, we began this whole series talking about, we've been overrun with the concept of naturalism, of evolution, that your first man was a caveman, and there's no way Noah could have built this because he's only 10 generations from the Garden of Eden, he's just 10 generations from being a monkey. And so how can he do all these things? And so it's easy with that kind of insight to just kind of back off this story. And some of the great guys I admire, when they get to this part, they say the only way we can explain this is it was a local flood that was used as an illustration of a bigger picture. It's like, well, okay, I hear what you're saying, but that's not what the text is saying. This is compared by Peter to the second coming. So if the flood was just a local flood, then the second coming could be just like a little local revival of people coming to Jesus. It was the second coming. It happened last week. It's like, no, the second coming is going to be an earth-stopping, world-changing event that every eye will see. The flood, likewise, was life-ending, world-changing, and every eye saw this. I mean, I've got to go with that. And so these things have to make sense. They have to fit in reality. With these exceptions, I'll read through this list and we'll quit. Here's some things, and you don't have to agree with this, but it is completely logical. Back page, page 10. There's going to be 371 days of the flood. We cannot assume, and you do not need to assume, that before the flood, climate zones were the same as they are today. The poles were frozen, there's deserts, there's hot spots. That you don't have to assume that, because everything changes with the flood. You don't have to assume the various animals inhabited the same areas as today, because one of the jokes is, well, how are the penguins going to waddle all the way down to Mesopotamia? You know, how are the polar bears, how are the panda bears going to get over there from China? It's like, well, wait a minute. If you've got, I've got to quit. If you've got potentially, there's the earth, and you've got this one landmass, this is potentially what it is, and then the tsunami, the fountains of the deep burst forth, and the continents are going to break apart. If here, you're not going to have the polar caps, you're not going to have the chaotic earth that we've got. And now that it breaks apart, here's the different continents that we've got. And you're going to have different climates. And each is going to develop their own ecosystem, their own food, their own, well, here it is. Various animals inhabited the same areas as today. Meaning, you don't have to assume that there's all these different animals that you only find in China or in on the South Pole or in Colorado. Geography of the earth was the same as today. You don't have to assume the geography was the same, nor, and you should not, you cannot, the Bible teaches this, you cannot assume the topography of the earth was the same as it is today. I know it's hard for us to think about it, but there was a day, even science knows this, there was a day the mountains were formed. Now, some want to say it took millions of years, or someone, you know, there's a day the mountains are going to fall. Even people sing songs about it. They seem like they're eternal, but yet the flood would explain how the continental plates moved, the mountains were formed, and the oceans sank. And you say, well, I have a hard time with that. Well, okay, when Jesus comes back, there's going to be a topography change. We read it in Zechariah that Jesus' feet will land on the Mount of Olives. The Mount of Olives will be split. Jerusalem's going to be lifted up. Revelation, and again, you can say, well, this is just a word picture, but it talks about every island disappears. It's like, well, what's that mean? Well, if we're talking about stuff like the flood, it means every island disappeared. The topography changed, and they sank under the... It's like, has that ever happened before? Well, they find cities under the oceans today. So, topography was not the same. The global flood caused tectonic upheavals, massive erosion, and laying down of sediments. The Arctic and the desert zones may not have existed before the flood. Intercontinental barriers with high mountains that separate continents may not have existed before the flood. Also, there would not have possibly been the jungles that we have today and the open seas that we've got. There was water, but it's not going to be this huge gap of sea separating these. After the flood, the animals developed their specific diets in their specific climate zones after the flood. I mean, meaning this world today is not Noah. So the question, how did the penguins get there? That's a fair question, but you're assuming the flood happened in our world today. If you hadn't had the flood, what would the world have looked like before the flood? That may not even be a question. And there may not have been, again, we don't believe in evolution, but we do understand, we can test, we can see adaptation, animals adapting to their climate. The narrowing of the ecological niches created a specialization among the animals that limited their diets, developing animals such as tree sloths, giant pandas, koala bears or koala bears. These are all things that when we look at this story, people will sit and make fun of it, but if you kind of step back and allow it to be what it is, this flood is going to be, we're going to change history. It's going to change science in a sense. Not that science is going to be changed, but there's going to be things that are happening that don't happen, that happened back then, that don't happen anymore. There's going to be animals we've got today that they never had before. The world is a different place. And so some things remain the same, but this is going to be a change. Just like when Jesus comes back, I think some things will continue the same, but there's going to be some drastic changes. The curse will be removed. Saint will be locked up. He will rule the earth as a king. There will be no democracy when Jesus comes back. It's like, what? No democracy? No democracy. How's it working for you today? We'll talk about that some other time. I will pray, and we'll be done.